We're fostering really good relationships with NSF. This is a really great grant program, and we look forward to how we can assist this effort and how grant and work with grantees, you know, toward our common objectives. The FCC Spectrum Policy Initiatives will really present, you know, a very high priority for Chairman Powlett and the Commission. We see ourselves at the cusp of, you know, tremendous opportunities in spectrum policy and spectrum-based technologies. A lot of finger-pointing goes around, you know, about what the problems of spectrum policy and this scarcity that Joe has talked about, how it was created, things like that. But there are a number of solutions, technical, market-based solutions like secondary markets, flexible allocations, and less kind of like centralized government command and control approaches. And there's a regulatory approaches like removing antiquated regulations or barriers to spectrum access. That's kind of the things that we're focusing on at the Commission, and Ed will talk about some of those technical initiatives and how they play into all these solutions to some of these problems. I made a presentation to the Commission in November and talked about one of our new initiatives, and that's kind of focusing on R&D, research and development, and fostering these kind of relationships with academia and the scientific community. And this is, you know, all a part of that, and it's also a key component to our implementation. If you see some of the documents put out by the commission out of Ed's shop, you know, it asks for a lot of input on research, like in receiver performance and the interference temperature. So before I introduce Ed, just want to point out we have also some other FCC folks in the audience that'd be very helpful, and I think we'll be available to chew the fat a little later and answer any questions about our initiatives. Rashmi Doshi, who heads the lab in Columbia, Maryland, is here and helping with that R&D effort for our task force. Dr. Mike Marcus, key player in this task force and part of OET, and just recently named IEEE Fellow. Jim Miller, one of our young up-and-coming talented engineers in the back there in OET. Keith Larson from our Media Bureau, and I call him the father of interference temperature. He headed the Interference Avoidance Working Group in our task force before, and so any questions about his concept of interference temperature, he would be happy to chat about. And now here's Ed. Come on up, Ed. He's leading the implementation of our task force technical proposals, and we would, you know, of course, benefit from, I'm sure, his input in this and his effort. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter.
Not bad.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you what I'd like to do. I'm going to take about 10 or 15 minutes to just set up some concepts. And then really I'd like to throw it open to questions, and we'll go as long as Joe allows me to go when he gets the hook. So, let me start. What I want to do is I want to give you a pretty good idea of the direction the FCC is taking in the next year to 18 months. And it might be rather surprising because it's actually addressing the topic that you have as research topics. So really, the future and the present are really starting to meet. Now let's see if... What do I do with this?
Well, assuming it's working.
Well, I got a great idea. Pop stuff down. Okay. All right. Cross your fingers, everybody.
Yeah,
that
wireless stuff.
My education allows me to do this. Okay. Let me start out with the mission of the FCC, and I promise you this is the only thing I'm going to read this morning. The mission is to ensure that the American people have available, at reasonable cost and without discrimination, rapid, efficient, nation and worldwide communication services, whether by radio, television, wire, satellite, or cable. In order to execute this mission, we've set for ourselves, the chairman set for the commission, six goals. In the area of spectrum, the goal is quite simple. Make more spectrum available for commercial use and see that it can be used flexibly and efficiently. In the area of broadband, foster broadband deployment in metropolitan, rural, and suburban areas. In the area of competition, basically level the playing field as possible, allow choices and economic choices for the American public in telecommunication, and take whatever actions that help that to occur. Media, primarily continue to move toward the digital transition is the primary goal. Homeland Security do everything humanly possible in order to ensure the integrity and security of the network, either from terrorist threat or national or natural disasters. And finally, I don't have to tell this group that technology is moving at a blinding pace. We have an internal goal to keep the FCC relevant and current. And that means in terms of the education and competence of the staff and making sure we have the appropriate technical equipment to do whatever testing and product evaluation that's necessary. With those goals as a backdrop, what I'm going to do is go through this thing at blinding speed just to set up the discussion. And these are the subjects I'm going to address very, very briefly. Let's start out with broadband. It's starting to take hold. Most of it at the present time is in the wired domain. The most recent data we have was 2002, but our estimate for 2003, there are probably 30 million broadband connections in the United States that are wired. And it kind of goes in a ratio of 2 to 1. The 2 is cable modems, the 1 is DSL. Wi-Fi, in terms of WIS, satellite, is starting to take hold, and we estimate there's somewhere between 1 million and 1.5 million access connections by satellite. And my definition of broadband here is the 1.5 megabit capabilities of that. Not quite the 200 and 300 megabits that we all aspire to. Does everybody in this room understand what unlicensed is? Or should I take a moment and describe what that's all about? I see a lot of blank faces. That means continue or describe? All right, I'm going to just pretend you know. Stop me if you don't. Unlicensed is taking hold in an unbelievable fashion. There are 400 million unlicensed devices in the United States today in operation. That includes everything from cordless telephones to garage door openers to remote entry devices for automobiles to baby monitors to Wi-Fi. In the broadband arena, the two interesting things are Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. In 2002, roughly 25 million Wi-Fi cards shipped and an equivalent amount of Bluetooth. In 2003, we think the number is probably over 30 million shipping. The market for this stuff is expected to be $5 billion in 2005. And you guys can do your own arithmetic, but Wi-Fi hasn't been around very long. So this is a real bang up success. One of the bright spots in telecommunication, because this all happened during the burst of the bubble. And it's growing at a very fast rate. And the good news story in all of this is it's starting to be used in places where nobody thought it would be used, like enabling WISP. There are public safety entities using unlicensed devices and Wi-Fi type devices in order to get broadband connections to patrol cars and the like. And there are business opportunities forming by the hour. Now, why is all that happening? Very, very simple in my mind. Technology is going in such a way that you can put more and more capabilities in smaller physical spaces at cheaper prices. And that's Moore's law in three dimensions. And the net result is it's a lot easier than it's ever been before to do really cool stuff in a very small box and sell it at a cheap price. And the biggest business problem that's around today, in my judgment, is to figure out what to package. There are way too many options that can be done. And that's, and you know, I don't know if any of you have the same hangup I do about the cordless, the remote access for your TV, your DVD, your home theater, and the like. I got 4 degrees, and I still can't run one. And what's worse, I have to put on my glasses every time I want to try to get it to do something. It's not exactly a good human factor design, but what they tried to do, and it's a very simple example, is basically shove a tremendous amount of capability in a small device. It's really not the best human factor. So what do? I use Freel. And you can see that happening in devices that are coming out on the market, and the entire consumer business and Wi-Fi business. So the challenge is to figure out what to package. Okay. This, we have a bunch of proceedings I'm going to take a moment to talk about. We strongly encourage you folks, either as individuals, as representatives from the institutions that work for, or as part of an association, to file in these proceedings. And what we're trying to do is enable new technology in a way that can provide value to the American public, but at the same time protect the rights of incumbents. And that's always the dilemma. We have a proceeding open on cognitive radio. To me, I use cognitive radio and smart radios interchangeably. My definition of cognitive radio is a radio that under software control can change its modulation, change its frequency, change its power, have sensors so it senses location or its environment and take certain actions that allow it to effectively use the spectrum it's authorized to use. It's an open proceeding that basically asks all the questions you ever wanted to ask about cognitive radio and were afraid to ask. And our intention is to go to a an R&O, which is a ruling and order, that basically enables this technology, tries to jumpstart it, but at the same time, it's almost like a Hippocratic oath, do no harm to the incumbent. Anybody in this room, either on the academic side, the commercial side, is strongly encouraged to file in this procedure. Either on a pro side that says, oh my God, this is what we think we can do with it, please make sure your rules permit X, or wait a minute, I've got some spectrum and if you guys aren't careful and attend to this problem, then you authorize this stuff, it causes me a problem and here's the technical thing. Think about this for a moment and combine it with noise temperature, or interference temperature. Interference temperature is a very simple concept with a very, very possibility of a very, very profound result. And by the way, this is also another proceeding. Everybody invited again, and I'm going to stop saying this. Every one of these are open proceedings to comment on this. And interference proceedings are very, very, interference temperature is a very, very simple concept. We set, or we are striving to set, a maximum interference level in a particular part of the band. And it's different from part A to part B to part C of the band. We would, in quotes now, guarantee the incumbent that the interference in that part of the band for which an incumbent has a license would never increase that point, increase beyond that point. However, anybody else can use that band as long as they stay under that hurdle. And then, so think about cognitive radio. You can sense. You can use that in certain instances and then jump out of that band to another band. The technology is here to do both. You have the intelligence to do the sensing. You also have the intelligence to skip out of one band to another as long as you know what the level is. The art comes in, and where the proceeding becomes a bit touchy is how do you set that level in every part of the band? Because you can bet your last nickel that whenever you go to an incumbent and say, I'm going to increase the allowable interference in your part of the band, you're kind of not very well received. And that's the problem. That's what the proceeding has. Pick two different bands. I think it was two. Peter, somebody? Was it two or was it more? Hello, come in.
Two.
It was two? Yeah, two bands. And the reason we started with two, it's a bit of an experiment. You know, we want to be conservative. We pick two parts of the band that at least are rather resilient because of what the incumbents are, and again, ask the million questions that you have to ask about this. If it becomes successful in those bands, our intention, obviously, is to move forward and do it in other bands. It's been a very, very, let's say, animated debate. Just a point of information, but that is probably not all that interesting to this group. We're also beginning a proceeding next week on the use of power lines to deliver broadband electronics. OFDM technology has gotten to the point that now that it's practical to turn every outlet into your home to a 1.5 megabit broadband distribution port. And we're in the process of beginning a proceeding to make sure that this can be delivered, and to also make sure, since you're going to be doing this over the power lines, which weren't really designed to transmit things at this frequency, to make sure that spurious interference doesn't cause harm to the incumbents of which the emissions will occur. And these things typically operate from almost DC up to and including about 60 megahertz. And there are some ideas about even taking them up to 100 megahertz. So you're basically sending 100 megahertz over a power line that was designed for 60 cycles. And you can imagine there are some rather profound technical problems to make sure that the incumbents are protected. Okay. We're also very shortly, with high likelihood, going to make available something in the order of 120 megahertz for advanced wireless communications, the so-called 3G. And what I've got up here is just the spectrum. We're obviously going to do this and assign it for flexible use, but this is something, as you well know, has had a false start in Europe. And in my judgment, the reason it's had a false start in Europe is the Europeans were extremely prescriptive in the features and functionalities that would be allowed in that band. We're not going to do that. We're just going to make the bandwidth available. Most likely will be available at auction. The incumbent will have a great deal of flexibility in order how they see fit to use that band. So that's an additional 120 megahertz that will most likely be made available shortly. Unlicensed technologies, we've been very, very active in that area. Made available 255 megahertz at 5 gigahertz. And there's a proceeding that's basically a rule, an RNO that does that. We have an open proceeding now, and this is something that, obviously, again, we welcome comment on how to use the white spaces in the TV spectrum. I don't think I have to tell this group there's always been a technical argument around that says, well, the use of the TV band is inefficient. I haven't been very receptive to that argument for a very simple reason. It depends what standard of efficiency you use. If you use bits per hertz, no argument, it's inefficient. If you use number of human beings reached per hertz, you get a totally different answer. But that still doesn't beg the question, that still begs the question, is there any way we can use that band more efficiently than we are presently using? Please translate that to me. Let the TV guys do their thing, but at the same time, don't interfere with those cats and see if you can use it in a different way as well. And our concept, and the proceeding is open, is a very simple question. If you were in New York City, you would find out that Channel 2, Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 7, Channel 11, and Channel 13, as an example, are already used. Channel 3, Channel 6, Channel 8, Channel 12 are all vacant. And each one of those is a 6 megahertz slot. Question is, and the reason being is, if you go 150 miles away, it's inverted. Those channels are used and the others aren't. The question before the House is, can you use those vacant spaces using cognitive radios that may know their location in such a way that you can provide broadband services and not screw up broadcast? And again, this is an animated public discussion, as it should be. Comments welcome from everybody in this room. I guess it should be obvious to you folks there are tremendous research opportunities here for the long term. The question that is very significant to me in the job I presently hold as chief engineer of the FCC is we don't want to take actions that inhibit the fruit of the research in the future by just setting up barriers right now. So we're trying very, very hard to only establish barriers, in quotes, in order to protect incumbents in a legitimate fashion. So one of the things that would be very useful from you folks is the kind to tell us what you think we may need to enable, either today or in the future, or some things maybe do not set up a barrier in this area because you'll screw up a whole line of research and innovation that may lead to X, Y, and Z. And I think you got to consider that. Obviously, if our job is to weigh the public interest and to really try to thread the needle here between the rights of the incumbents and the ability and need to enable technology and innovation. Tremendous amount of research opportunities, and certainly there's a tremendous amount of business opportunities. I'm not going to belabor that. There are also regulatory problems. Almost everything we do is a conflict, and a good conflict, and a constructive conflict, between rights of incumbents and what innovators or newcomers are trying to do. Even though the spectrum is lightly used, if you use the time dimension, almost all of it has a license attached to it. So you may have an incumbent who is using the spectrum intermittently, but his license says he owns that piece of real estate. It's like you own a home, a summer home. You get rather upset if you're not there, if me and my wife and kids showed up to use it. And that's the way they view it. It's not a property right, but that's really the way they view it. So one of the things we have to do in every proceeding is understand their legitimate concerns and weigh that, as I said before, against the need for new and innovative services. And that becomes a very constructive public debate. And we do that time and time again. Philosophy is exactly the same. The particular item or specifics of that item are just different. And that's what at least a lot of us at the commission do for a living in the technical area. There's another thing which is a troublesome public debate, and I'm going to stop here and throw it over to questions in a second. There is an argument of asymmetry. You have some incumbents who come to us and say, look, we spent N billion with a B dollars at auction to get a piece of and now you're enabling these guys to do unlicensed things. They compete directly with me, and they don't have the embedded cost of having to, if you will, win the spectrum license at auction. And they're starting out with a $2 billion head start to me for a particular service. That is an argument you cannot ignore. But also, you cannot give it, it can't be a veto power. That's what I mean by the asymmetrical nature of some of this. We're making available, as I said, with high probability, 120 megahertz of licensed spectrum for 3G. That's going to be at auction, most likely. Okay. One of the things an auction does is give you a license with some, in quotes now, strong protection against interference. In the unlicensed space, you have no regulatory protection from interference. The only protection you get is from the innovation of the technology that you deploy. And that's a constant debate as well as we go do our work. Let me stop here and we'll talk between Peter and I and the rest of the FCC gang. We probably can answer most of the questions that you folks may have. If we don't know the answers, we'll make them up.
Yes, sir. You have a very large tenant in the U.S. military who owns a lot of spectrum in UHF, SHF, and EHF. And I happen to know that no matter how you use efficiency measure in terms of bits per hertz or user reach per hertz, it's basically epsilon, right?
So it's basically what?
Epsilon, very small.
Yeah.
Okay? And no matter what you do, you're not being able to, at this point in time, to use part of the spectrum. But I happen to know that the system characteristic there is extremely tolerant to low-level interference. In fact, was designed to be like that. So is there any way the FCC, are you having any discussion in dealing with this problem and try to use some of the sweet spectrum that they're using?
The answer to your question is yes. In fact, there's a couple of things I want to say. And unfortunately, I'm going to give you maybe a longer answer than you want. The NTIA is managing a spectrum policy task force under executive order from the president to basically take a look at the entire government spectrum and find out the efficient ways to use it, and that includes DoD spectrum and the like. And the FCC is an observer and a kibitzer in that proceeding. But let me make the point. DoD is an easy shot if you're not careful, and I don't think it's always legitimate. Because the standard, and I used to be in the military business also, okay, and I used to make a lot of things that went boom in the night. The standard is different. Because there are two things you try to do in military. Number one, you want resilience to jamming on the battlefield. And number two, you want to be covert. Both of those are profligate in bandwidth. And you can't, it's subjective. It really is subjective. Is 2 gigahertz of bandwidth really necessary for the frequency hopper that works at low level? Or would it really work better at 1.5 megabits? Well, obviously 1.5 gigahertz. Obviously with 2 gigahertz, you have a little more protection from detection and you can provide more resilience. But is that extra 500 megahertz really necessary? We started today. I think it's very important that everybody understand that the military has a different standard than we do. That doesn't say we shouldn't have the argument and continually have the debate, and that's what the president's had the NTIA manage. But it's like the TV broadcast spectrum. There are different standards. I quite often think the military may be using more than it needs, but I gotta tell you something. If the life and welfare in this country is dependent on the military, I'd much rather error on the side of giving them a little more than they need than give them a little, and I'm really serious about that. So that's a debate. It won't stop. On occasion, the military, either under act of Congress or through negotiation, gives some spectrum back. 45 megahertz of that 3G spectrum is reclaimed from the military, as an example. The 255 megahertz of the unlicensed, we worked with the military in order to protect the military system by including a thing called the dynamic frequency selection. So we're always working with them. And contrary to popular belief, and I don't want this to go to your head, they are reasonable people. Yes, sir.
There's an audio recording, right?
Yes, I opted in, too. Yes.
Yeah, I want to make a comment about the 3G. I was brought up to work on the 3G system since 97. There's a creepy side.
I
was working on 3G for many years. And some people said in U.S., one reason U.S. is delayed by 3G is because we don't have the spectrum. So can you comment on that?
Well, I mean,
because when we work on 3G and we don't have the spectrum, so some big company like Lucent and Motorola cannot dedicate resources for that.
The question was, one of the reasons for the delay of implementation of 3G in the United States because there wasn't spectrum available.
Yes.
The direct answer to your question is yes. But let me explain why. I mean, very, very precious spectrum occurs from around 100 megahertz on up to 10 gigahertz. And if you look at the spectrum in the United States, it's all licensed or has government use. One of the things we did is we worked very diligently with the government, with the NTIA and DOD, declare that. There was also an act of Congress that said that had to be done, and by the way, you have to protect the systems that are in there, and you have to decide where things move, and all that kind of thing. So it took some time to clear it. But honestly, I lived in Europe for 2 years, and I ran a company in England just when 3G was going. It was a blooming disaster there, because it was an answer that nobody had a question for, really. And companies were trying to give back spectrum. So the fact that we delayed was not necessarily a bad thing, because the need wasn't, delayed is the wrong word, it took longer to work the process here. Honestly, I think even if the spectrum were available, we would not have made it available for 3G. We would have made it available, as we are going to make it available, for advanced wireless communication. And now, whoever wins the spectrum within a great, great broad range of flexibility can do whatever they want. If they want to use it for voice only, fine. If they want to use it as a pure data service, fine. If they want to do some combination, God bless. And that's a lot different than 3G in Europe, which every I is dotted and every T is crossed to what's allowed and what isn't. I didn't think we lost a lot in this. We got plenty of time. I'll try to cover everybody. Yes, sir, in back.
I mean, for the notion of interference temperature.
Could you raise your voice just a little?
For the interference temperature, is the notion that you're working with similar to what we have in place for UWB, or would it be the case that if a particular band isn't used, then that interference temperature would go up? And related to this, if we're using a frequency hopping system, how are you going to measure the interference temperature? Are you freezing the hopping, or are you allowing it to run an average over some period of time?
I'll give you an extremely technical answer. Let me be serious for a moment. First of all, ultra-wideband is an example of interference temperature. It happens to be a very, very, very low number. The darn thing below is at the noise floor and below. The question we're asking ourselves is in certain parts of the band, can we make that number higher than the noise floor to give some headroom for innovators to use that part of the band in conjunction with the licensed guy without causing harm for those guys. You would certainly do it differently in a radio astronomy band where you need a real quiet signal than you would in an uplink for a satellite where the satellite transmitter is facing upward. It's got a half a degree beam with it. It's transmitting in hundreds of watts. So that's what we got to figure out. How we would measure it is honestly still an exercise for the student, and that's one of the things the IMF. And I wasn't kidding, that's the public debate. But at the end of the day, certainly one philosophically could say ultra-wideband is the first instantiation, or a instantiation, of interference temperature. Those of you who are familiar, I'll be there. Those of you who are familiar with North Point, the proceeding, I'm not going to take the time, is another one. And that all happened before we invented the concept in a more general fashion of spectrum policy task force. And now the question is, how do you go forward in an orderly fashion, piece by piece in the band, and authorize it in a way that's useful, but at the same time doesn't screw up the incumbent? And screw up is a very technical term. Yes, sir.
Do you foresee significant use of data broadcasting over digital television channels, or do you think they'll just be used for small amount of site data related to the television?
The question was, do I foresee data broad in digital TV, do I see interactive data, basically? Honestly, the capability is there. It's a business decision of the broadcaster, and honestly, I don't know. The capability is built in there. They have an opportunity to use it and create whatever innovative services that may help them with their business plans. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the VHF TV band and where
it goes up. I just didn't want to tell you every because I don't know them all by heart.
Well, I don't necessarily know them all by heart either, but there's a heck of a lot of UHF channels.
That's all part of it. That's all part of it. That was an example. It goes right up to almost 800 megahertz.
Yeah, because you get the 850 emergency services.
Yeah. And by the way, the item deals with that as well. I just was using that by way of illustration.
Along those lines, what is the schedule on that, and would it be feasible, do you think, that those would be possible to use for research use?
The schedule gets hard to say, and let me say why. Not because I'm trying to do the Washington two-step. It is, as you would think, a rather animated proceeding as far as the broadcast is. And it was an NOI, notice of inquiry. Our rules require that an NOI be followed by an NPRM, notice of proposed rulemaking, and then a rulemaking. Every one of those, if everything goes according to Hoyle, almost takes Peter helped me here. I would say 6 months a shot if it worked really well, and could take a year or two if it doesn't. But in the interim, that doesn't say we wouldn't grant an experimental license, which could be granted like this in certain locations. So the answer to your question is, if I were to guess, to an RNO, we're probably talking somewhere over a year from now. And it might be closer to two, depending on the intensity. We're going to try to move as quickly as possible. But then again, you just can't blow off real concerns. You have to understand them. On the other hand, if anybody thinks they want an experimental license to play in this area, come talk to your friendly, sensitive FCC. There are things we can do there with an SDA. No, I'm serious. That was not a facetious comment. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Then a different part. It's been quasi-routine to get authorization, higher power in the unlicensed band on an interfere basis. And the things I'm involved with do that routinely because the proof of concept developments then are relatively inexpensive because the equipment's relatively inexpensive and readily available. Do you foresee a continuation of this exception?
I'm going to say no, but you're going to like what I'm going to say. How do you like that for code? Look, we are starting to ask questions in more and more proceedings as to public interest aspects of allowing higher power in the unlicensed band. So when I said no, my hope is it's not going to be an exception forever. There'll be certain parts of the band that may allow higher power than the 1 watt maximum that's presently allowed. And that's under active consideration. There may be an item coming up very shortly that basically explicitly addresses a part of the band and asks for public comment. But it would be inappropriate for me to give you the date, but it's good, not serious. It just wouldn't be right. But it's pretty soon. And it basically says, okay, in this part of the band, what does the world think about allowing higher power and significantly higher than 1 watt under certain conditions, of course. Does that answer your question? Yes, sir.
You mentioned modernizing the FCC. Can you comment more on that? And specifically, I'm interested, are there any plans to make the policy in a form that's more suitable for processing by a machine?
Policy more
suitable for machine readability. The current policies are all written as law. Is there any move for a small portions of it maybe become available in a way that machines can read and interpret them?
Well, you asked me two questions.
Yes.
The first question is, what are we doing to modernize the FCC, and then had a specific set about machine readable stuff.
Yes.
Very quickly, when I say modernize the FCC, and I'm sorry, I shouldn't have put this in my mouth, but when I say modernize the FCC, I mean two things. Make sure that the skill set of the people that are in the process of making the rules and doing the analysis are up to the task of where the technology is, and that's education. The second thing is making sure they have the instrumentality, both the computer instrumentality for modeling, and the empirical instrumentality to do the measurements to verify the theory. Okay? And we're doing that. And the chairman has been absolutely unbelievably supportive in that, as have the commission. And a lot of money has gone into both education and equipment. You go down to Dr. Doshi's lab, who's sitting directly behind you, and I used to run an industrial lab. And I got to tell you, you could put it right next to the best industrial RF lab, and you'll see the equipment exactly the same. And the skill set of the people are there as well. That's number one. Number two, in machine readable, I'm not quite sure what you mean, but let me give you an example. We authorize unlicensed devices. We have a website about basically which can get all the technical characteristics of all the devices we do. It gets 14 million hits a year for 39,000 a day. Certainly one could write a program to interrogate that thing and read it. Are we really setting a program up to do that
in a very proactive way, but beyond keeping the website current, at this point, the answer is no. Are you getting the hook ready?
I think I am.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. I hope you found it useful.
Our next speaker is Bill.